I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
TF3 with TF2 on the weekend. Tuesday, we know we're a little late. We know the analysis might be a little after the fact, but it's fine. Kristen's here to analyze. I'm here to ask many, many questions, and a lot of them have come in over the weekend, and a lot has happened since. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm not bad, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good. A lot's going on, and a lot's been happening in football. Just this evening, we watched Man City just about edge past Bristol City, Chris, as they book their trip again to Wembley. Bristol came back, I think it was from behind, 2-0 down at one point, to make things nervous for Pep Guardiola's side with the massive names in it. And this, Chris, is why they talk about the magic of Carabao.
Yeah, I thought the game was overall entertaining. I thought it offered a lot of insight into ways you can unsettle Manchester City. I think that Bristol's pressing was quite aggressive in the first half, and I think it certainly caught some of the Man City players off. There was equally, I think, a number of instances where they handled it quite admirably. The team overall felt a lot stronger than it did in the first leg, and I think Lee Johnson even said as much, that it felt like the kind of team they would name for a Champions League final. I think towards the second half, you saw maybe just a little bit more of a loosening of the game, which cost Bristol in the sense that it made them easier to pick off, easier to counter on themselves, to break upon, etc. Whereas at the same time, I would say actually that kind of allowed Bristol to really cause some problems in attack. I didn't think they caused that many issues in the first half in Man City's half of things, but when it came to the second period, you saw that sort of consistency in terms of getting those goals through Pack and Flint. But the problem is, and I think you found this with Liverpool as well, is that you can attack City, you can score against them. The problem is that also opens you up to being scored against, which is a major problem.
Yeah, I guess there's a huge part to this, isn't there? That actually, there's never really going to be one system which can last so long in football. And what I mean by that is, you can't just set up one system and then expect it always to beat every other system. There's going to be adaptations throughout a season. And sometimes, we saw the fallibility of City against Liverpool. And then ironically, Liverpool can win against the guys who are very top of the league, but also then lose against a side who, admittedly afterwards, the manager even said, I told my side, Liverpool are an F1 team. They're an F1 car. And what we need to do is sit back and stop them from going fast, make traffic around them, and essentially, make something which is difficult to get through. And, I think both sides almost came, Man City came unstuck to some extent, but not the same extent Liverpool did. But it means that teams are using their systems to get the better of what we thought were managers who could think around these sort of things, or at least train their players to think around these kind of things.
Yeah, saying that, I did think that in the case of Carvajal, it was less an enacted plan and more just a bit of good PR spin from him, because you look at
the chances,
the statistics on that game. Yeah, you look at the number of shots on target, the possession, those kind of things. I think that what he enacted or orchestrated in that game, which feels too grand a term even now, was a fairly deep block, to borrow one of Nico's phrases, quite a narrow back line that really just shut off space. And I think it was less about what Swansea did and more about what Liverpool didn't do or can't do, which is sometimes play through lines and tight space. And I think if Mawson doesn't finish that chance, realistically, we're looking at the entire game as being a 0-0 affair, because I don't think Swansea really created anything outside of that. I think for that game specifically, it's becoming something of a trend, I think, when teams in that bottom 6 to 7 places come up against the teams in the top 6 or 7 places, which is they look less to try and win the game and more not to lose it. And it's something that I could see developing into quite a concerning issue for the Premier League, because it is really founded and sells itself on the fact that it's entertaining, whereas these 1-0 games really aren't that entertaining when you watch them in sort of, you know, correlation with the rest of the games that finish that way.
Yeah, it's interesting because actually there's some other things that happen now in other leagues which we almost consider to be slightly more entertaining, especially in Serie A and in La Liga now, where I know there's a lot. There's many different things to watch outside of the chaos that is the Premier League right now. And it can be a lot of chaos. Liverpool, of course, created their own chaos as well, Chris. Man City also, of course, find themselves still top of the table by quite a distance. Of course, there's Chelsea as well, who, again, got through quite a chaotic game with Brighton to win by quite a comfortable margin for them. And I think they easily beat the South Coast side 4-0 in the end with goals from Hazard and Victor Moses as well. I guess there's still this, there's almost a feeling of inevitability about Chelsea, though, that this team isn't going to come to fruition this season because there's something wrong.
Yeah, I think ultimately not everyone is pulling in the same direction, and we've talked about this before, the lack of synergy between the first team and the developmental elements of Chelsea's infrastructure. I think, you know, almost ironically, I would caveat that with the fact that I thought Batshuayi, Willian and Hazard linked up fantastically during the game against Brighton. You look at Willian's goal being the prime example of that, where all three are involved in a way that's not only fluid, but I think unstoppable from a Brighton perspective. There's not really anything you could do if you reversed the game and gave them a second chance at it.
They definitely could have scored more, couldn't they?
Yeah, and I think certainly Brighton have issue or right to take issue with the fact they weren't given a penalty for Scilotto's fall against Willy Caballero.
Maybe two penalties?
Yeah, maybe even two. I think there's certainly an issue to be had there, but I think for me, when I watch Brighton personally, I think it's very easy to reduce it to the fact that Knockhart's form or levels of production have dropped off significantly this season. But I think in actuality, what you're seeing is a sort of replay, if you will, of Chris Hughton at Norwich City, which was a coach that, again, to go back to the point we made a little bit about Swansea and Liverpool, is a team more concerned about not losing a game instead of trying to win it. And I think it's not necessarily negative. I think it's almost overcautious approach coming to the fore and sort of costing him the opportunity, because Brighton are a very good counter-attacking team. I saw that last season, that they could really break on teams and exploit space in a very good way. The problem with that is that not every team is going to give you that opportunity. And there will also be teams that will find ways to play through you. And I think part of a Premier League side, or at least one that survives, part of their appeal or success is their ability to almost scare the opposition. And I don't think Brighton really scare opposition in that same way.
Do you think that's partly also the Newcastle problem at the moment? They don't seem to be scaring the likes of, well, I mean, it's very difficult to say whether they scare Man City or not. Not many teams do scare Man City. But do you think there isn't much of a fear factor around them, despite the fact that, as we record, they've just signed Kennedy?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think you can apply that to Huddersfield as well. I think in the first half of the season, Huddersfield were this dynamic, gegenpressing, another buzzword I can grab at, type of team that would scare opponents because they would be very much in your face and they would turn the ball over quickly and they would find an obvious pass and spring on you and almost wouldn't let you rest with the ball. Whereas I think you look at them now and it's a team that, for me, has lost its spark a little bit. And they did this last season as well. They kind of hit this wall towards the back end of the campaign and just squeaked into the playoffs. They had minus goal difference at one stage after sort of mounting what seemed like a title challenge, or at least a promotion challenge, an automatic promotion challenge, excuse me. And I think with Newcastle, it's less been of a Brighton-type situation and more less of a Huddersfield-type situation and more of a Brighton one, where they've been very defensively solid and that's admirable and that kind of thing. But I think teams know that as the game progresses, they lose their ability to cause them problems in the final third. And if you can sort of survive that opening wave of pressure from them when there's a little bit of zip and a little bit of zing to them, then there's a good chance that you can actually make the game 1-0. And I think, for me at least, looking at it, that's why Rafa Benitez is trying to get bodies through the door. And you look at Kennedy and you say, okay, maybe that's quite uninspiring. It's a Chelsea loanee. It's someone that's not getting regular minutes with them. Those are all fair evaluations of his position at Chelsea. But I think what you have to look at is what he gives, which is pace, a bit of trickery, a fairly aggressive, dynamic runner from a wide position. I'll be surprised if Benitez plays him at left back. I think he's got him there in case, you know, an eventuality arises where he needs a left back or a left-footed player who can play there. But I think for me, he'll be played much further forward. And the hope will be that he gives them some kind of change, because I think the same almost applies to Huddersfield and Alex Pritchard. They looked and said, look, we don't have a number 10, we don't have a creator, so let's go and get that. And I mean, you know, as I think about it now, you could even say the same of Brighton and Jurgen Locardia. They've all tried to give themselves something they feel they're lacking, but I think they have greater problems than those signings can rectify, personally.
And obviously no Gamero, Chris. Everyone got very excited for Gamero. We thought, this is on. No,
I don't think that was ever going to be viable, purely from the perspective that he's 31, would cost upwards of 20 million, and this is before we even try and entertain the thought of him leaving a very good football club for one mired in relegation.
Come on, though. I mean, you know, there are positives as well to playing under, first of all, in the Premier League, playing under Rafa Benitez, playing for a club where you're going to be appreciated if you can keep this team up in the second half of the season.
True, but I think it comes at the inherent risk of being relegated. And I think that, again, that in itself is not something that players really want. There's an arduous war of attrition with a battle against relegation. And I think for some players that simply doesn't appeal.
Yeah, I guess as well, though, maybe Rafa Benitez is trying to encourage the team to think that they are not one of the relegation fodder.
That's an interesting question, because I think Benitez often keeps things very open and honest, and he's very focused on the game ahead rather than the game two ahead or three ahead. I think Newcastle are in a very strong position right now, in so much as they're not in the relegation places. They need their rivals to pick up points, and they know that that's safe. 2 weekends' time, when they go to Crystal Palace, if they win, that puts them, you know, potentially in the top half. And I think this season in particular, it's tighter than I can remember for a number of years in that bottom half. And I think realistically, come the end of February, March, you'll have a much better idea on who are those four or five scrapping not to be in the bottom three. So I think, yeah, Benitez is probably trying to keep them focused solely on what's in front of them instead of worrying about games in April and May.
It was inevitable that we would get onto the Arsenal factor, Chris. I mean, we can probably talk about the result. First of all, on the weekend, they won 4-1 against Crystal Palace in what felt like a sort of a sad formality for Palace, as Arsenal pulled away, and some people accused Palace of downing tools, which seemed unusual. It just seemed a little bit more like they were poorly prepared and at times shocked by the way Arsenal played, weirdly, considering they were all sort of, set pieces, and then after that, some pretty classic Arsenal goals, really. Especially with some lovely piece of improvisation from guys who were not Alexis Sanchez. But it seems inevitable that we don't really need to analyse Arsenal on the pitch, because it's the off-the-pitch stuff which fascinates people right now. It's everything around that. It's the circus which seems to be created. And, you know, considering that Alexis Sanchez left this weekend, revealed himself playing a piano. Of course, why wouldn't he be playing a piano? I genuinely don't know why he was playing a piano. And then going out on the pitch and saying he's been a lifelong United fan, all these sorts of things. It's fascinating, really. First of all, swap deal in the Premier League, which most people said, well, that's never going to happen. You're never going to get a straight swap. That never happens. It does. And then at the same time, the fact that Arsenal got Mkhitaryan, who so many United fans have been talking up for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah, I think you beautifully surmised the situation there. I think in many ways that's been the intriguing element of this for me, is to see essentially two sides trot out their respective propaganda about why they've got the better half of this. I think for me personally, to look at it, I think both teams really got the best possible outcome, because Manchester United, I think, wanted something a little bit different in attack. I think they wanted someone who perhaps could be an individual that drives the team forward. We've seen that with Alexis when he was at Arsenal. There were moments where, I think to the Cologne game in the Europa League specifically, where he very much picked the team up and dragged them forward. I think that's kind of what Mourinho wants in the final third. Where that fits positionally, or where that sort of sprouts positionally, I think is still to be determined.
Yeah, I see.
And at the same time, I think
Mkhitaryan's a great signing for Arsenal.
He really is, and I think, look, you could have taken the fee that Manchester City were offering if he'd been able to agree a deal with Man City, but 25, 30 million, that's it, 35 at most. I don't know if that gets you a player of Mkhitaryan's potential quality, given the way that the market has fluctuated so aggressively the last 18 to 24 months. So, as I say, I think it's very easy to make out like Man United are the winners in this one, because, you know, they've got this player on form who theoretically changes the way their attack lines up. But I actually think for Arsenal, it's the best possible outcome that they could have wished for.
I mean, it is definitely going to change. I look forward to there's a lot of tactical breakdowns online. I think both teams got the best out of what was a very painful and awkward situation for some of the parties involved. Mkhitaryan on one side, and then obviously the Arsenal fans and Alexis on the other. Of course, Chris, there's also the outgoing at Watford, which seems interesting at this point, doesn't it? Because for a very long time, we thought, well, you know, Marco Silva is going to have a bit of a challenge anyway. We didn't see it being this much of a challenge. If anything, I think a lot of people put Watford quite high up in the table with Marco Silva as the manager. But then when this big offer came along from Everton, Watford have been, ever since, sort of very transparent about the way that affected the club. And it was unusual to see sort of how transparent they almost openly acknowledged where they were in the table, what impact the approach from Everton had. It made people almost feel uncomfortable the way that they acknowledged it in the press release that they put along with Marco Silva leaving the club. And some people now also say, Arsenal, this is the perfect time to let Arsene Wenger step down, bring someone like Marco Silva in, and begin to be a more pragmatic, changing club, which could be one of many plans.
Yeah, I think Watford's statement spoke to a club that was frustrated that their potential plans had been derailed. I think ultimately, yeah, this is a club that operates on a very short-term MO. You look at the change from Kiki Sanchez Flores and those performs even Slavisa Jokanović, who, you know, it seemed would take them into the Premier League, but didn't ultimately. I think the frustrating part came that they weren't ready to let go in that moment. In many ways, it was always a marriage of convenience, Silva and Watford, because I think Silva had aspirations far higher than Watford.
Do you think Stoke are at all angry about the timing of Watford letting Kike Sanchez Flores go? Do you think Watford was sort of like, wait until they fill that position, wait until Lambert's gone there, then bam, we let him go?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think possibly. I mean, look, Silva's reputation is an intriguing one right now, because 12 months ago he was potentially seen as one of, if not the most exciting managers in English football. He was the mini Mourinho, and I think the problem is that ambition to be at the top level is ultimately what cost him, because I don't think he thought pragmatically himself when it came to the situation with Everton, because really, I think Everton from Watford is essentially the same job, but with greater financial clout. Whereas if he had perhaps played his cards right, he could have got that Arsenal job. Now, there's still a chance that he gets that position.
I guess it's just problematic in a way, because you sort of think, well... Although, yeah, I think Watford were a very unique example, weren't they? And people are talking as if there's maybe a black mark on his card because he wanted to leave the club. And, you know, what people are saying, almost criticising for, is he wanted to chase climbing the table by swapping clubs rather than by just taking Watford up. And I guess part of the problem is, Chris, that a lot of people, they judge the status of Everton, they judge the status of Watford, and they think, well, how many points difference are those teams going to finish on? How many places difference are those teams going to finish on with different managers? And they sort of think, well, if Marco Silva's destined for an Arsenal or someone around that level, why would he go to an Everton? Why not go to that next, just slightly higher tier of clubs?
Yeah, I can see that. I think, as I say, what this position with Watford has done is perhaps brought into question him a little bit in a negative light, as you referenced there, because ultimately it's painted him as someone that's point of fault. But also, now that he's left, you shine a light on the situation in its totality, which was he wasn't happy with the delegation of responsibilities when it came to transfers. He wanted more power, he wanted more say. Now, let's hypothetically say that he was to go to Arsenal, given they've just implemented a structure that does remove a certain degree of power from Arsene Wenger. Is he going to be willing to work with that? Is that going to be seen as something that will perhaps dissuade a club from approaching him? The fact that more and more you're seeing clubs move towards that model with a director of football or some kind of committee or council in which signings are weighed up. It's very rare, I think, now, Guardiola perhaps being the one major exception, where a manager is allowed to sign with complete free rein. Now, in fairness to Silva, he pushed hard for Richarlison, who has turned out to be a very good player. but also, I think, yeah, his once perceived adaptability or pragmatism when he was at Hull seems less prevalent with this Watford job because of the way that it's all unfolded. And I think that is perhaps what will cost him more than anything.
Obviously, I referenced Stoke just a few seconds ago. Great, some people thought. Finally, we can talk about the refreshing approach of Paul Lambert in the Premier League. Because for many years, we thought of Paul Lambert as this maybe slightly outdated, maybe a kind of Paul Jewell-esque character. In time, we sort of see that he needs maybe little breaks in between. Because between those, he gathers life, Chris, injects it into a side, gets them to a certain level, and then leaves. It's Stoke.
I do think personally I'm a little bit wary of jumping from one pole to another on this one, because I think, yes, it was a fantastic win. They outplayed a Huddersfield side that, as we've discussed, are quite poor. At the same time, I think, yes, there's credence to the notion of taking a break, of stepping back, reassessing your practices and refining that process, because I think that has worked for coaches in the past. I think you look at Alan Pardew, who, after a spell away with Southampton, came back and had arguably his best performance as a manager early on at Newcastle. I think at the same time, it's going to take a little bit more than that. I think it's not terribly dissimilar for me to situation with Carlos Carvajal, where, yes, you can beat Liverpool at home and that's fantastic, but using the same methodology, surely you should have beaten Newcastle away from home, who are a significantly worse team than Liverpool. I think to that end, I should almost need a little bit more data or experience before I can come to a conclusion on the situation with Paul Lambert, because I think, yes, it's a fantastic start, but I don't know if it's proved anything conclusively.
Elsewhere, other leagues are roaming along as well. Roma and Inter drew 1-1 at Giuseppe Meazza in San Siro. Juventus, obviously, the top of their league, but Napoli also top of their league, because Napoli got the win against Atalanta as well. Chris, there's still worries that this Napoli team will drop away because of the thin squad that they have. But at least they're still challenging, and at least they're still in a position where people are forced to question that rather than saying they've already dropped away. And there's something very encouraging about that, because in previous seasons by this point, we're not seeing many people challenging events in the way that we need to see them challenging. And there's something about that satisfying 1 point between the two sides.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's a fair estimation of things.
Yeah, I've just got to say, I'm really excited by Napoli this season, although that might be because my local barista isn't a Napoli fan and just shares genuine happiness every time that they win on the weekend. Elsewhere, of course, Real Madrid finally got an absolute thrashing of a side. Deportivo La Coruña took a beating, with Cristiano Ronaldo getting two, Gareth Bale getting two, Nacho also getting two, in a 7-1 win, obviously, for Real Madrid. Maybe they need to build this head of steam, but we'll see what's going on there as well. Obviously, Barcelona also got the massive win as well against Real Betis. 5 goals, none of them Coutinho, in that Coutinho didn't play because he's still injured. Luis Suarez obviously getting two, Messi getting two. Something about scoring two this weekend if you're in La Liga. And there's, I guess, the frustration, Chris, is that when we thought that either of these teams may or may not be dropping away, we thought maybe a Valencia or someone like that could get in. Maybe Atletico Madrid could catch someone at the top, but Barcelona are 11 points clear of the nearest rival, being Atletico Madrid, and Real Madrid are they 19 points off the top? So they're just not going to catch this Barcelona team this season, and we're probably going to see this Barcelona team cruise to a title.
Yeah, I think we are, and for that, I think Valverde deserves immense credit.
Right, but then everyone else has let them get to that point.
To a certain degree, I think that's a fair estimation of things. I think one of the things that strikes me about Real Madrid is the regression in the supporting cast. I think, yeah, Ronaldo is not having the kind of season that he normally does in La Liga. In the Champions League, he's pretty much on form from everything I can see in terms of his goals ratio and what I've seen. But I think you look at the absence of players like James and Morata, you're seeing what is, to me at least, a drop in the quality of supporting cast. And I think that was that to me was pretty much one of the strongest elements of the Real Madrid squad last year. You just need to look at the Champions League final and the influence that someone like Asensio had coming on and scoring goal. Real Madrid had real good depth that I think has lost them.
Certainly looking interesting over there. I'm looking forward to those Champions League games as we come back to those. It's going to be some great action. I'm really looking forward to that PSG Real Madrid game. It's setting itself up quite nicely, Chris, as well, because Neymar doesn't seem like all that much of a popular figure right now in Ligue 1. There are even rumours that he might even end up at Real Madrid at some point. It's actually really quite fascinating to look at the dynamic that he leaves behind, because it almost seems, and I know other journalists have been speaking about this, but it seems as if Neymar almost doesn't really care about the legacy that he leaves behind at clubs, because he's just sort of sailing through them. It's about Neymar. It's not about, you know, maybe if you go to Napoli, you see Maradona. If you go to Barcelona, you'll see Messi. If you go to Liverpool, you'll hear about Gerrard. You'll hear about, who was the last Everton legend, Thomas Gravesen. You know, you'll hear about all these players and you'll think, wow, he really left an impact on this city. Doesn't seem the same with PSG and Neymar.
No, I don't think that was the intention of the relationship. I think it was a situation in which it was two parties that had shared goals, not necessarily linked to anything other than the wanting to win the Champions League. I think the reasons were slightly different, and yet eerily similar, because I think they wanted to elevate themselves through that achievement. In so much as I think Neymar wanted to distance himself from Messi and the supporting cast that played a role in them winning the Champions League against Juventus, whereas for PSG it was about being taken seriously. I don't think anyone ever contested Neymar was a world-class talent, but it was often seen that his achievements were in part due to the performances of those around him, whereas I think for PSG they want to feel as if they are at the elite level, and until you win the Champions League, I think it's an often trotted out criticism that those who haven't done that can't really be considered elite.
Or maybe not also when you're not beating your nearest rivals, who are 8 points off you, off the top. On the weekend, obviously PSG fell 2-1 to Olympique Lyon. They only got mishmash of a side. You know, they've got Nabil Fekir in there, Chris. And then obviously it feels like they're sort of, I don't know, a few years ago we felt like they were much more powerful against these PSG sides. And obviously they won on the weekend, which is fantastic for them. But Neymar didn't even start. Kylian Mbappe came off with an injury. This PSG team, to me, Chris, still doesn't seem like I guess what I'm trying to say is, it doesn't seem like, for all of the effort and money spent, still doesn't seem like there's very much to be satisfied with this PSG side. It seems a little empty. There seems to be a lack of heart.
I think it really does fluctuate between two poles, and at the core of that is a sense of apathy towards the situation, because PSG have spent more on a player than most clubs, if not all clubs in France, spend on their entire summer business.
Right.
They cherry-picked their great, you know, the title rival's best player last season in Kylian Mbappe, and it almost feels a little bit soulless when they do win, or when they do put six or seven past an opponent, because it's almost what you expect. You know, there's no great achievement in doing that. At the same time, I think when they do lose, it almost, again, it feels irrelevant, because they're still going to take the the league in title realistically come the end of the season. And I think in watching them, you see a team that has spent a staggering amount of money, and yet at the same time, personally, I don't see them winning the Champions League this season. I see a team that has still fairly heavy deficiencies. I don't think Levin Kurzawa is a left back of the quality needed. I think central midfield, they still have issues. Defensively as a whole, I'm a little bit sceptical about how they handle big situations. And I do think, looking back now at their Champions League group, it seemed like it was actually a little bit misleading, because yes, they had the champions of Scotland, Bayern Munich and Anderlecht, but really Anderlecht have been very much off the pace this season. Celtic rarely have a difficult game domestically, and Bayern's games were punctuated by the fact that the first one was before Heynckes came back and the second was after, and I think I take more from those results than I do from perhaps the 7-1 demolition of Celtic.
Yeah, certainly an interesting... I mean, yeah, that 7-1 demolition of Celtic, it's just refreshing to see some good football. The thing is, Chris, obviously we want to make a longer podcast, but we are not joined by the likes of Nico, the likes of Dave, the likes of Adam, as we've tried and promised we would at some point. But we do sort of have some points to cover from the weekend when different people have tweeted in. There have been a few replies to us so far, Chris. I mean, one of them, which I'm really interested to talk to you about, is the idea of a lot of people tweeting us about the idea of, in inverted commas, austerity Chelsea. Now, with Laporte and Fred both rumoured to be signing for Man City in January after an incredible transfer window in the first place, Conte seems to be going the opposite way, the current champions, if you like, against the champions-elect spending, and saying Sanchez wages were something they couldn't compete with Manchester United and Man City for, and that he thought it was, and I think this is a direct quote, a miracle that Chelsea won the league just last season. It's interesting, isn't it, how far, how Conte is trying to keep this Chelsea team competitive in some way, because it seems a lot like he's fighting an uphill battle. At the same time, though, he can't get Andy Carroll. He can't get any of these English guys. Not that it seems like he wants them, because of the laughing at his press conference. It seems to be a lot of confusion around the club right now. A lot of mixed messaging. And a lot of people very confused as to whether Conte and the future of the club is stable enough to even attract players.
Yeah, I think that is one of the issues, is that you're potentially signing for a club and a coach that may not be there in the summer. I think, as we've talked about before, there's a certain issue in terms of Chelsea needing some form of long-term stability. Now, there are a few different ways to go about that. One of them is to appoint a long-term manager. I think another one is to actually define how the football club plays, and then approach coaches accordingly, who will keep the continuity there. I think that's difficult for Chelsea, though, because they have preferred to operate on a way that's a little bit more ad hoc, whereas whoever they feel will deliver the results they need, that's who they feel is the prime candidate. It's quite Machiavellian in that sense, and I think it will eventually, and I think we're maybe starting to see the first sprouts of it here, have an impact on the players that they can sign, because not every player wants to run that risk of being there and say, like Michy Batshuayi or someone like that, have a situation where they can't find their own continuity because the club has next to none itself.
Well, imagine if I was Morata, I'd be a little annoyed at all the rumours. I don't quite know what someone like Morata might be thinking, but he has had very little support this season. Even though he does have a fantastic player around him, it seems as if Conte speaks in a quite a defeated attitude right now. And I wonder if that's because he knows that he doesn't really have to maintain this side much longer. It certainly is an interesting one. I'll be interested to see whether Conte is there next season, especially considering the current state of AC Milan. Where they're going, etc., etc., etc. Chris, anything else interesting going on in the football world that you'd like to cover?
Sunderland won at the weekend.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Through youth and exuberance, I think, more than anything. Chris Coleman's trusted a lot of the club's development squad, Joel Osoro, Josh Meyer, people like that, and they've come to the fore, which I think, credit to them for seizing the opportunity.
VAR has obviously been confirmed at the World Cup. Chris, good news for some, bad news for others. It's going to be sponsored. Even better. Now we can see people get furious at a brand for VAR outside of getting furious at referees. Surely it will be better by the time we get to the World Cup. There'll be some kinks ironed out.
I would hope so, definitely. I think it's an emerging technology in the context of football.
Video.
Because there are nuances to that.
Do you think they're using VHS?
Possibly. But I think it has a process of refinement, of course. That's fairly normal. It's just whether we have the patience to see that through, I think, is the most important thing. Because I think we're quite demanding at the best of times as a sport, and instant gratification is a central theme of that. And so it's a case of whether we can wait through that for the potential benefits that it will bring.
It's exciting stuff for this World Cup, but we'll see. I'll be interested to see how they implement it, etc., etc. It's certainly getting more interesting by the day as we get towards the World Cup. We've got a couple of months. Will certain players be fit? Will certain players even make it into the squad? It's worth keeping an eye at least across who's going to be in the England team. Very rarely do we know. Chris, it was interesting to see Alexis Sanchez take number 7 at Manchester United, wasn't it? Because obviously some United fans claim it's cursed. Other United fans... Apparently it's Michael Owen who can uncurse it. Other fans saying he follows in a great line and a long line of fantastic number 7s. If you were to move to a new club, you got a choice of your number, what number would you go for?
10, I think.
You do. I put you a bit slightly deeper than a 10, though, but I see why you want it.
Yeah, I mean, 10, 6, whatever works for that.
I like you as a 6.
Said that in a nightclub once.
Yeah. You're a perfect 10.
But, I think for Liverpool, for Manchester United, the number 7 is. It is and it isn't quite an illustrious number. I think it, personally, I don't think it's always had that same relevance. It's had great players, but it feels like more that was a coincidence
Michael Owen.
A habit.
And Angel Di Maria. And, Beckham, obviously, and then you think of all the greats that had gone just before that. Obviously, there are some fantastic names in there, I think, as well. And you think of some of the greats, Georgie Best, etc., etc. It'll be interesting to see how those guys get on over there at Manchester United. He might make his debut Friday night. I think it's in the FA Cup, which is why we're not doing the kickoff this weekend. Thank you very much for joining us. You can get in your Qs and your As for later this week. Maybe you want to ask a Q. Maybe you want to give an A. If you do want to give an A to this podcast, go and rate it 5 stars. The more stars you give, the more likely Dave, Nico and Adam are to appear on the podcast. So please do go and give it a review over there. Chris, if people want to go find your work, there's a lot of places online to find it. Is there anything in particular you would recommend they read this week?
I'm in the midst of writing something about Phil Neville getting the England job.
Following all the Twitter... issues.
Yes. And just in general, the cronyism that surrounds it.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. It's certainly going to be interesting. He deleted his account as dubious tweets. He said, he is said to have sent Emerge, former Everton captain, honoured to be named women's coach. Certainly an interesting one. Apparently, yeah, there's a lot of interesting tweets he sent here. A message. No, there's all sorts of unusual things. I would rather that we know that these are legit before going into them. There are battered women mentioned in them, for instance. And it seems... Yeah, it's an unusual move. We'll give him that. Let's see. Go read Kristen's article to get a start, and then we'll go... We'll go from there. And until Thursday, when we'll be doing the Q&A, enjoy your week. Let us know on the Twitter at the front three what your thoughts are on the current state of football, what you want to hear discussed. And we'll see you again real soon right here on the front three.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.